IVM.
Hello and welcome to the Ganatantra podcast. I am Alok Prasanna Kumar.
And I am Sariyu Natarajan.
And in this week's episode, we are joined by Pranay Kotastane. Pranay is a faculty and fellow at the Takshashila Institution, where he also heads research. He is also co-host of Pulya Bazi, a Hindi podcast on policy, technology and society, and writes a monthly column on Indian foreign policy for Rajasthan Patrika. Welcome to Ganatantra, Pranay.
Glad to be here, Sariyu and Alok, and congratulations for completing 50 episodes.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. We're going to bring that up.
Yeah.
And this is also a crossover podcast episode.
Exactly. So that's great. And today we have Pranay to talk to us about fiscal federalism. This is a term which has different meanings depending on whom you ask and in which country. And of course, as you may have heard, it's money and not love, which makes the world go round. Mm. And this is a matter which causes a lot of passions. And those of you who have followed...
We're recording the day after Valentine's Day.
Exactly.
Come on!
exactly why. But also, some of you may have noticed that recently the 15th Finance Commission has come out with this interim report. And this interim report has stirred some passions across the country, most notably in Karnataka, Kerala, and other South Indian states such as Andhra and Telangana, which feel that they have been shortchanged in some manner in the way in which the centre allocates them some money. Some of you may have also noticed that there is a huge controversy going on about the compensation being granted to states by the centre in the context of GST. You may recall that the centre had promised by law to compensate states for any shortfall that they suffered in revenue when it came to post-introduction of GST. And now the center is struggling to be able to meet those shortfalls. And the shortfalls have in fact gotten much greater and greater. But this is just the surface level of it. And we really want to go a little bit in depth. But let's start, Pranay, with by just understanding, and for a lot of our viewers, for our listeners, how does tax money go from various parts of the country to the center, and how does it eventually get distributed?
Right. So I generally start with this. How many governments are there in India, do you think?
So let's see. There's a union government. I'll count all union territories as one and say, okay, plus Delhi and Pondicherry, that's three. And 29 state governments. Oh, no, 28 because Jammu and Kashmir has suddenly lost it. So that's 28 plus 3, 31 state government, 31 state and central governments. If you want me to include all the municipalities.
This urban local bodies.
You have to include because they are.
Okay, so let's say there's 110 in Andhra Pradesh, which has a population of 110 urban local bodies.
Okay, there are 2.5 lakh governments.
Okay.
So this is starting to sound like a McKinsey problem solving case.
So I wanted to bring that up because generally when we talk about government finances, those smaller levels of government just get missed out, right? And that's the whole problem. So in a sense, what we are discussing about is these 2.5 lakh governments and what are these governments better at doing, which kind of spending decisions are done better at the local level, which are done at the state level and which are done at the union level. Yeah. That essentially is what fiscal federalism is.
Right.
So there are, it's a branch of public finance and there's a lot of literature right from the 19th century on what should be the principles governing these spending decisions. So let's come to the Indian case, right? Every federal structure has a different mechanism. The Indian mechanism is as follows. So broadly, we didn't have local governments recognized till 92, right?
Yeah.
So until then, what we had was, we have the state governments and we have the union governments.
Right.
And the way the constitutional constitution envisages the division of responsibilities is that physical infrastructure is generally going to be provided largely by the union government.
Right.
And social infrastructure, that is health, education, etc., will be in the domain of states.
Right.
Okay. So this is like really broad classification. So this is on the spending side. On the revenue side, what you have is the broad-based taxes like the income tax and corporate tax are generally assigned to the union government, and then they are then distributed to the states from this divisible pool. That is what the Finance Commission does. And states also have their own productive tax handles, like agricultural income taxes with the states. We don't raise much money out of it, but it's still there. And then you have VAT, VAT, and then now you also have things like excise duty, etc. So this is how the state governments raise money. For the local governments, now after 92 we have local governments as well. The interesting part is there's a birth defect in how those local governments were formed. It's up to the state governments to assign revenue handles to them. So some state governments have assigned, say, property tax to the local government. Some state governments have not even done that. So it's a very uneven distribution. Broadly, I would one stat that sort of explains all this is 60% of all government expenditure in India happens through the state governments. Right. But only 40% of the state governments are able to raise only 40% of this entire pool. Right. So which means there is a 20% deficit. How do they make up for that? That's why you need union governments to transfer money.
Right.
That's how it's structured.
Right. And that's because in a sense, this is interesting because Saru and me are both lawyers. When we studied constitutional law, this was not a subject anybody covered.
Barely scratched the surface on federalism, and then fiscal federalism was like, hey, these functions exist.
It exists. Don't worry about it.
It was done in Consti 3.
And in a sense, first of all, just understanding the architecture, I think it was only when I was working with Vidhi and had a chance to assist in a finance commission project that even understood the architecture of it and why it's so important. And we never really thought about the importance of the finance commission as an institution, that it is one of those non-partisan institutions whose functioning has never been subject to any real serious study or criticism in any way. And only now we're slowly sort of seeing that level of critique or some level of discussion about it. But what you said is very important, that we have to keep in mind that for any state, it has these two broad, state government at least, it has these two broad sources of revenue, where one part of it comes from the union government and one part is what it gets by itself. Yeah. Right. So for example, if we take the Karnataka state government, duties on alcohol is what is its own revenue. It fixes the rate, collects it and does it. But whereas say, of the income tax collected from Karnataka, some part of it comes to Karnataka. Likewise, for the union government, it doesn't spend every last rupee it collects. Some of it just goes unconditionally. But some of its spending has to happen through states. I mean, if you think about something like, say, MNREGA, there's no union government in every village in this country to be able to, spend that money. It has to go through the states and filter it through. But I think we can pick up on the first point of tension, which is, how much should the center give the states and how much should it keep for itself? But can we, let's talk a little bit about the implications of saying 42% of the union's revenues go to the state. What does it exactly mean for the states, and how much should the union actually be sharing and so on?
Yeah. So in order to answer that, let's go to the basics, right? Why fiscal federalism eventually? Because we are talking about comparative advantage, right? Yes. You have diverse preferences in a country like India, and you need governments to be able to identify those diverse preferences. That's why you have subnational governments as well, right? So the logic is that a person who's sitting in Karnataka and in Bangalore will be probably be able to identify preferences of the regions where there are Kannada people better than someone in Delhi. Okay, and that's why you have some functions assigned. And if you see the division, it's mostly the allocation of public goods is with the state governments, right? So that's why
that all social policy is done at the state level.
So that's why they have a large amount of spending also, which happens. Okay, so given this fact that 60% of the expenditure and on critical areas such as health, education happens through state governments, it makes absolute sense that more and more money goes to the state governments first and less to the union government.
Yes.
Okay? So you have to look at it in terms of two forms of sharing. One is vertical sharing, which means how much money will the higher level of government give to the lower levels of government. So that's what you say when 34 versus
42.
42. So 42 is with state and 58 is with union, right? And then there is horizontal sharing. So between these state governments, how will it get divided? And that is again a formula which gets derived by the Finance Commission, which first decides 42, and within 42, 1% to the state, 2% to the state is dependent on horizontal sharing.
Yeah.
So that's like broadly the architecture. So to your question, it is, as I said, it is great that there is an imbalance, right? Yes. There's a vertical imbalance, 38 versus 60% spending, 38% revenue. So it's good and it's in the right direction that state government should get more and more unconditional funds. So these are not tied to any schemes when it comes through devolution. Whatever money goes through income tax, there's a formula that the Finance Commission decides. And without it going to the union government's coffers, it directly goes based on that formula to the state governments.
Right.
So it is a more enlightened approach, right? It is that let states decide what their priorities are. Kerala might not want to spend on education and Karnataka might. So let that.
So, you know, to talk about this horizontal sharing that you mentioned, could you speak a little bit to the consideration set and the criteria that are adopted in deciding what state gets 1% and what gets 2%? And could you even describe the process in some ways? Is there a claim making by state governments based on which there is a decision? Because this is a formula that's revisited. Because that is the entry point for politics, especially in the federal context that we're looking at. So
actually, I think the more important part is the vertical sharing. Mm-hmm. But let me answer that, the horizontal bit first. Okay, so the horizontal bit, it's all messy. Okay, so earlier there was Finance Commission and there was the Planning Commission. Yeah. So both of them used to do these transfers. And it was the Planning Commission often was discretionary transfers. Mm. There was a formula brought in by this Gadgil formula, but the amount given through that was quite less. So I'm not going into Planning Commission. Let's discuss now what is the state. So Finance Commission is this body. It is through Article 280 of the Constitution. So it is a constitutional body, right? And it is every 5 years it is appointed. It reports to the president, not to the government. And they basically come up with, they are generally economists or people with experience in the government who are supposed to sit together. They meet each and every state government. So they visited Karnataka and the Karnataka government makes a submission to them saying, you know, this is our expenditure requirements. This is what we've been doing, etc. So they meet all of these people and then they go back, they devise a formula for vertical sharing and for horizontal sharing. And then that is submitted to the president. After that, the government then accepts or rejects their recommendations. Generally, in India, all governments have accepted the basic formula for the vertical and horizontal sharing. Yeah. Till now, there has been not much disagreement. Once this formula is decided, the money just goes through the state governments and they receive it as a revenue receipt in their budgets.
Budgets, yeah. This is where I want to take on that point about the formula, right? Because that formula so far was seen as some sort of a technocratic exercise. For those of you who are unaware, what the Finance Commission does is give each state a score. Okay, now the score is based on 4 to 5 factors. I think this time they've used the maximum number of factors. I think some 7 they've used, if I'm not mistaken. And they give each factor a certain weightage. In the past, the maximum weightage was given to a concept called income distance, which means they will rank the states from richest to poorest, and the richest state gets the lowest factor, poorest state gets the most factor, right? So the richest, on the basis of per capita GDP, state GDP. Yeah. So I think as per the 2014, the 14th Finance Commission, the richest state was Haryana and the poorest was Jharkhand or Bihar, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if it has changed fundamentally. I have to check the latest report once it's out. Mm-hmm. That used to get the biggest weight. But there were weights for population, area, forest cover. And in the latest Finance Commission, we have seen weights given to improvement in fertility rates, tax effort, and also, I think, efficient use of money. So I would say this is a very political exercise, right? In a sense, we have all been assuming that this is just some sort of mathematics that, you know, they just come up with these numbers and everybody puts them everywhere. But given the debate that this time that has happened, these weights are very political, right? Because I think the biggest shift that has happened is that in the past, they used population figures from 1971.
Yeah.
And now they've used population figures from 2011 census. Yeah. And that is a significant change. So let's discuss a little bit about how these weights have been.
And I think just to sort of add to that, right, the politics around the population has been that some states, particularly in the South, have seen a more rapid decline in population growth rate. So the idea that if it is related in any way to that, to the number of people in the territory of each state, states that have actually made advances in terms of their population growth are going to potentially get penalized for what they've done. Yeah. And this is particularly the states of Tamil Nadu and Karnataka. And it became a Tamil Nadu and Kerala. And it became a political issue in the context of, Chief Minister Siddaramaiah, then Chief Minister Siddaramaiah, writing a piece about how it's problematic that states that have shown development, you know, actually get penalized by the Finance Commission formula. And so it became political, and it also became partisan because of the central state government issue.
Actually, I fundamentally disagree with that. So let me put my disagreement forward. My take is that we should focus more on the vertical imbalance and have more money coming to all state governments instead of state governments quabbling with each other.
Right.
Now, let me say why I say this, right? So if broadly, like you said, like formulas which are used. So first of all counting is political, right? And I mean, no counting is apolitical. So even this will be political.
Yeah.
Broadly, there are four factors which are used across all finance commission. One is need. So second is equity. So need is based, let's say population is an example of need. Equity is if you have a poorer state, you need to, poorer region, rather, you need to compensate. Then the third is efficiency, where you have this fiscal performance, or you can have even demographic transition coming into. And the fourth one is fiscal disability. Again, if the states are not able to raise money on their own, then you will need help. So these are the four broad things. In that, you have, sometimes you have area, sometimes you have forest cover as a fiscal disability, right? Because if you have forest, you don't, you can't do any activity there. And you want to incentivize people to still have forest, right? So it is, so there are various things you put in this pot. But broadly, these four factors are there and they have changed across finance commission. But what you will see is in any democratic structure, need will still be an important part.
Absolutely.
You will not be able to. And it is patently unfair for you to divide money today based on your population in 50 years ago, right? Basic unit in the constitution is the individual, right? So we have to look at how much the money is going to an individual. It doesn't matter if it is, I mean, how can we argue for more money going to a richer part compared to a lower part, because equity considerations get broken down, right? So on the population front, I think it's great that we are using recent figures.
Yes.
And 2011 census is fine. We are, in fact, we should be doing on 2021. Because we need to provide governance for now, not in 2011 or 20.
And the numbers have changed visibly.
Second point, on demographic transition, I agree to that point that some states have done well, but Finance Commission is not Family Planning Commission.
Yes.
True.
Right. I mean, then we can say there are many other things on which states need to be compensated, which is population, then other.
Also, this is not a first prize granting competition, right? On anything, whether family planning or any other metric. Exactly. So, this is not the Finance Commission's job.
So, we are bringing another factor on this Finance Commission and hoping that it will try to balance out population inequities, which I think you are just expanding the scope of this institution, and that's where the whole problem becomes. You optimize for too many factors and you end up achieving none. So that's why I think it is okay with 2011 census. Having said that, so the basic disagreement is on this criteria that some state governments raise more money. And there is this money, so a part of this money is going to the union government, and that is, there is a feeling it is not coming back. That I think is well taken. It is a real problem, and that's why I think we have to move towards greater money coming to state governments.
And on that point, I think what we don't see, again, going back to the earlier point that you made about the constitutional structure, the union has been given powers to tax those parts of the economy which are fundamentally cross-border, whether international or interstate, right? When you're talking about excise, which is goods manufacture, which goes everywhere part of the country, income, which could be earned in any part of the country, corporations can function anywhere in the country, whereas states are given power to tax those activities which are necessarily limited. So at the a transaction happens somewhere in a particular, like one transaction, like if you want to club all your excise on alcohol and everything, it's a transaction tax at the end of the day. Property is located directly in that state. And necessarily, so when we say, and I think this is the change that I think this happen, needs to happen in the discourse. When we say that, you know, income tax collected in Karnataka was so much, It just happens to be collected in Karnataka. It is not reflective of the actual value being added in Karnataka, because a lot of corporation tax is basically filed in Bombay, Bangalore and Delhi.
That's why you come up with those numbers, right? 38% of tax is paid in Mumbai. Exactly. Come on. Yeah. I mean, how
that,
is that?
That doesn't make sense, right? That tells you the flaw in the calculation rather than any actual value addition, so to speak. Because, I mean, sure, Mumbai is a very dynamic place, but are you telling me that it is adding more to our economy than every single industrial part of this country? No, absolutely not.
It sounds, yes.
Yeah. It sounds wrong. And that's the point that I think a lot of people miss out in this debate about this horizontal devolution of funds, that it's not a prize. You know, like as Saru pointed out, it's not a planning commission or a first prize kind of commission, that it is to meet equity needs. But having said that, and I think that is a very valid point, that why not just ask for the pie to be made bigger?
Yeah.
I think this particular time, we have seen a very interesting development which has come up in this discourse about fiscal federalism, which is this claim by the union that there have to be certain funds set aside only for defense and internal security. Now, this worries me a lot, right? In the sense that states also contribute to internal security. Why are you assuming that the money you're transporting to, money that you're sending to, say, Bihar or UP isn't going to buff up their state intelligence or buff up their police forces or buff up their thing? Because at the end of the day, you need people on the ground. Why are we assuming that the whole burden of defense of the nation or internal security lies only with the union? I thought we could discuss that a little bit.
Yeah, I think you make a great point, and I think it is unconstitutional.
Right.
Okay. The way I see it, I mean, we should not be under any, the fact that union government does a lot of shady things in this is, we need to understand that. We often, people say it is India is a federation with a unitary bias. It is all true. Okay. We are a heavily centralized system, and it plays out in a lot of ways. You know, what happens is, even though we have this division between concurrent list and state list and union list, but union government still spends on state list freely, right?
Yes.
I mean, why is it spending on health? It creates its own centrally sponsored scheme. This is outside the finance commission.
Yes.
They create their own scheme because they want to have Pradhan Mantri, this yojana
or
that yojana.
It's political.
Yeah. And they will say, state governments, you contribute 40%, I'll contribute 60%, but this will be Pradhan Mantri yojana, right?
Yeah.
So now what you've seen over time, and in fact, 14th finance commission conducted a research on this, union government spending on concurrent list subject is increasing.
Right.
So they are not able to do spending on what their functions are, which are defense.
Yes.
But they are spending on the things which are in the domain of the states.
Yeah. Yes.
And a lot of state governments had complained in the 14th Finance Commission itself that we don't want these centrally sponsored schemes, because you commit our 40% expenditure also. We can do that ourselves. This is in our domain. Okay, so this is the reality. Now, defense is in that itself. Now, defense is a union list subject.
Yes.
If the union government wants to create funds, it can create today.
Yeah.
Why do you want to give this to finance commission?
Yes.
This is just placing the monkey on their back.
Yes.
Yeah.
They can. They have a fund for Swachh Bharat.
Yes.
You have a fund for Shiksha.
Yeah.
Shiksha Kosh or something like that. So you have funds for a lot of things. If you want, you can create a fund right now. No one is stopping you.
Yeah.
But why they are doing this to the finance commission? Because they are saying, see, state governments also have to contribute to this great favor that we are doing.
Yeah.
How is it a favor? This is your responsibility. You make money out of it. If you can't provide for it, it's your mistake. Find the money.
Yeah.
So I think that still remains. And that's why they are placing the monkey on the finance commission back, to take more money out of the state government's kitty and put that money separately as a fund, which will be utilized by the union government, which is, I think, unconstitutional. I don't know.
I think the interpretation being that defense or national security is primarily a central government thing, and to Alok's point that state governments have no real role to play in it, is kind of a false premise to start with.
Yeah.
And also to the extent that you need to interpret security as not just spending on defense and intelligence and police forces, but also the social element, which is what conditions enable more security to prevail.
Yeah.
And to that extent, that is something that's in the realm of the state governments through the social policy that the constitutional allocation does.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's problematic to, exactly to your point, to use the relationship of the finance commission to pull responsibility into themselves without necessarily following it up in terms of consequences.
Yeah, so they're just trying to corner more funds.
And before we go to the bit about the sub-regional...
But fiscal... but fiscal control is political control. And so therefore, the more money you have, the more money you can have at your disposal to allocate it in ways that are quote-unquote political, in the sense that it speaks to partisan interests.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why my idea is that all state governments should form a coalition to ask for more money to themselves, instead of one state government's fighting against the other. Then the union government has it very easy. They can always say it is need based. It is, I mean, those formulas are just formulas, right? They can give any weightage.
Yeah.
But so the whole idea is that if, so actually earlier there was this, you had this interstate council and all those mechanisms, right? They were supposed to do this function of intergovernmental bargaining, right? Where all governments come together, say, which is broken now. Those things aren't happening.
But tell us how, in the current arrangement of partisan politics, right? How is that going to be negotiated? You have one central party. You have a few regional parties that are in power in certain parts of the country. How is that going to play out potentially in the current context? And is there any evidence that we have from the past in terms of how these interstate councils functioned to drive towards more equitable or, you know, more meaningful ways of allocation of funds?
Before Pranay gives the sensible answer, I have an apocryphal story to share.
Okay.
I think this happened. I'm yet to find like a solid source for it, but I've heard multiple people repeat this story.
Well, if two people testify to it, it's true. You know that from law school.
So after N.T. Ramarao became chief minister, and remember, the second largest party after Rajiv Gandhi's overwhelming win in the 84-85 elections. He was basically the leader of opposition with like 35 parties in a regional thing.
Sounds familiar.
At one interstate council meeting, somebody thought it was a good idea to reverse the order in which the states would enter. So, interstate council meeting, they enter in a certain order, right? Because it's a fairly big deal and everything. Usually, it used to be Andhra, Arunachal and so on. Somebody said, let's start from the opposite. We'll start with West Bengal and so on. N.T. Ramarao threw a fit. He said, I'm walking out of this meeting. I will not attend this until the order is restored. Andhra was first. This is humiliation for us if we don't go first.
Right.
All right. Basically, the answer, I suppose, and they had to go backtrack on that. Whoever in the bureaucracy decided to make the decision had to backtrack because this guy threw such a fit that they had to say, okay, fine. We'll go back to the earlier alphabetical order. I guess maybe childish petulance petulance is the way forward. But
Well, this reminds me of the debates in law school around whether your attendance should be called with alphabetical order A to Z or the other way around.
Wow, and you guys have some fun debates. Good, glad I was not part of that.
But yes, the sensible answer.
Yeah. No, I think interstate council as a mechanism has broken, and the only way to reform it, I think, let's see the examples that have worked. One, GST council is an example and a way forward, right? Where states have a 50% say, which is great, right? And each state has an equal say. And also, if you see 14th Finance Commission itself was an example where state governments rallied to say that, you know, this is not fair. Why are you running so many centrally sponsored schemes in our domain? And the commission had to respond, right? And it changed. So in that sense, we are moving towards that direction. And the fact that we are having that debate itself says that we are taking federalism and fiscal federalism seriously. So I see some hope. Maybe I'm being more optimistic here.
But on the GST Council itself, actually, this is one of the things that I wanted to bring up and that's come up naturally in the conversation. For those of you who are unaware, the GST Council actually, as we have it today, was a big change from the GST Council as proposed by the Congress. And actually with the way the VAT Council worked, the VAT Council would recommend by consensus the rates. So all the states and the center would sit together, figure out the rates, and everybody would agree to follow it, right, in whatever way possible. GST Council, the first drafts for the GST Council amendment, or the GST amendment to the Constitution, replicate this process. At some point, it changes the mechanism that you described. States have 66% weight.
Right.
66% weight. Each of them get an equal share. But decisions are taken by a majority of 75%.
Yeah.
33/4 majority. This, nobody noticed this change except one person, Mr. Navneet Krishnan, MP of AIADMK. He wrote a dissent note in the Rajya Sabha Standing Committee, which assessed this amendment. What he pointed out, and it remains true, nobody has answered this effectively, is that this ensures that the union government is never in a minority in any decision taken in the GST Council. So the GST Council can, even if every single state agrees, can never pass a decision unless the union government also agrees, right? It effectively gives the union a veto. But if the union can get about a third of the states, approximately, or of what, one third to half the states to agree, it can have its way fully, right? Actually, about half the states, at least. About half the states, if it gets to have its way fully, even if the other half the states are violently opposed to it. And we actually saw that happen, by the way. For the first time in December, or was it in January, a measure was actually put to vote in the GST Council about lottery taxes, taxes on interstate lotteries. And some states were in favor of taxing them at the highest slab of 18%, and some wanted a 28%, and some wanted a 12%. And the 12% won out, as if I'm not mistaken. Even the mechanisms that we ostensibly have on paper are giving rise to these tensions now.
I think it is again a reflection of the centralized bias, right? That's what happens. So basically, the union government can propose something and the state governments can probably dispose something.
Yes.
But if the state governments propose, it's definitely not a guarantee that it will pass.
Please let's not forget that this is all tied up into partisan interests, which is that who is the state government in power also matters in terms of how these things play out. So it's not entirely just a logical, like a technocratic policy decision, because at the end of the day, if there is a different government in power at the state level, this decision would be valued differently.
And now that you will have one government and one party which had it was in power in many states at least a year back, you would obviously have in the current context everyone following one leader.
That's right. And I just recalled that N.T. Ramarao's story was told by Mr. Y.V. Reddy, who was chief secretary of Andhra at his time, if I'm not mistaken. So hopefully we will one day bother him about that. So,
by the way, since you said Y.V. Reddy, his book on fiscal federalism is a great read, and the way it is written is very approachable for anyone who's interested, and has a lot of fun anecdotes as well.
I hope this is somewhere incorporated into that. Mr. Y.V. Reddy's book is released. He's actually co-authored it. Anyway, we will give the link in the description to the podcast once we're done with the episode.
You know, I was going to pull away from center versus state to the next level, which is state or into urban local bodies and all kinds. So the 2,49,700, 800 odd governments. Well, that are, I guess, the backbone, the core of our governance in the country. And what does, you know, what are the issues one should be thinking about in the context of federalism? To some extent, it's, you know, easy to stand back and say this is a failed system, but these governments do play a role in terms of implementing social policy as well as being the last mile of the political interests of their masters as well. So how do we think about that?
Absolutely. Eventually, you need to have these governments to provide for a lot of local public goods and local services as well, even if they are private, right? So, for example, some of the things in Bangalore itself, right? We have a public transport system which is run by the state government. Our local government has no play in this, right? So, you have these special corporations created by the state government. So, that's perfectly the point that one, now we should start thinking of what the state governments are doing with the resources they have. And there you'll see a sorry story. For example, like the Union Finance Commission, there needs to be a state finance commission as well. And those finance commissions don't work. No one asks for them. I mean, forget that. The fact that our state assemblies meet only for on an average 29 days a year.
Declining rapidly too.
And out of that, 15 days are spent on state budget discussion. So you... all the things that you do for elections, you end up just 15 days of discussion, right? So from that, it flows that there is no state finance commission also, and there are the systematic transfer of these resources to the local governments doesn't happen. So we have to fix that. I mean, a lot more awareness should be spread that we need that. Second is this idea about giving more tax handles to the local governments itself. Because if they raise more money, they'll be able to decide on their own, just like the logic. So there is a term for this. It's called Vixellian connection. Okay, it's technical, but it just essentially means there should be larger overlap between three things. Those who pay, those who benefit, and those who decide.
Right.
So they should be coincident.
Yeah, yeah. For local goods. So now if you see in our system that is broken, right? I mean, if the pothole outside your house is broken, I mean, the money, where do you pay? Most of the property taxes are not collected. So yes, you are going to eventually pay most income tax, which is going to the union government.
Yeah.
And by the time it is going to your state government and state government decides to that's lost. So this Vixalian connection is completely broken.
Is it an index of some sort of that you can measure your
probably, yeah. I have not thought about that. But yes, you can make a Vixalian disconnection index.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah, we are not there at all. The general principle to increase Vixalian connection is wherever possible, charge locally.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, for example, if you have user charges for a lot of things locally, and this money gets directly collected by your local governments, they will be then able to provide services better.
Mm.
That doesn't exist now, but that's why we advocate for parking charges, for example.
Yes.
I mean, in Bangalore on MG Road, I park for free. That money can be collected by the, we've done a calculation actually, that amount, if all wards in Bangalore just charge one road for parking, they can raise close to 500 crores. It's like 10% of the revenue that BBMP has.
Yes, yes. That's a lot. And the thing is that, by the way, the biggest advocates for such a parking fee, and I think almost to a man, you will find them hit the streets in support if you propose this in the government, are Uber and Ola drivers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm the kind of policy nerd who will start talking transportation policy anytime an Uber. But it's also very engaging conversation.
We won't say the Uber word. That seems to be your keyword.
So. Uber, Ola. No, but inevitably, we get talking about traffic.
Mm.
And most of the time, they have all the correct intuitions about this.
Mm.
They have all the right policy solutions about this. And inevitably, the discussion comes down to, sir, these road cars parked on the road, sir, we have to tax them.
Mm.
Oh, we have to tax them.
I didn't know that.
No, it is. And multiple Uber and Ola drivers, they have I've had this conversation with. And everyone is like, I sort of say, in other countries, what they do, they're like, oh, great, we should have that here.
Okay, there's a question for both of you guys. We were discussing there's this bird defect, right? The state governments can decide which revenue handle should go to the local government, which means public choice theory tells us state governments are never going to let go of more functions.
Yeah.
So is there a time to talk about the fourth list in the constitution now and make this, something which is sacrosanct and not at the whim and fancy of state governments? Yes.
So let me plug a little bit of our Vidhi's work. We work by Vidhi Center for Legal Policy. We don't believe just a fourth list. I think the three lists need to be re-examined.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have a fourth list. Yeah. Actually, I would say it should be five lists.
Okay.
But it requires a complete rejig of the three lists also.
Yeah.
The little bit of history here is the three lists that we have date back, 99% of it date back to the Government of India Act of 1935. Pretty much copy-pasted that. There have been some changes of shuffling, but I think fundamental re-examination is needed. We have come out with a report which we sent to the Finance Commission. It's on our website. You can share the link. I do believe that these three need to be re-looked and we need to add two more lists. The two more lists being one exclusively in the power of panchayats and urban local bodies, and one where panchayats and urban local bodies have a concurrent list with the state government in question. Right? So the state government lays down the standards, whereas they do the local legislation. So in that way, just to give a little bit of background, since this is also a lot of work that I do, so you have the Karnataka Municipalities Act and Municipal Corporations Act. They prescribe certain things that the municipalities and municipal corporations should do, but the state is allowed to prescribe model bylaws. Okay, and it's not possible for Karnataka's 288 municipalities and several tens of thousands of panchayats to come up with their own bylaws. So something like solid waste management, perhaps, it might make sense for the state government to lay down policy, to lay down broad frameworks, and the bylaws be left to the relevant local bodies.
Yeah, and I think to Alok's point also, and to your question, there are realms like technology, for example, which cut across various domains in both the central and the state list. And what has happened now is that very many of the conversations around tech policy are getting framed at the central level. But take, for instance, health and the implications that, I'm speaking loosely, but health data have for the citizenry as a whole. how to navigate these kinds of terrains are also something we need to discuss in the context. So like these cross-cutting themes, maybe they are to be negotiated in different ways depending on the context. And it doesn't speak to fiscal federalism as a concept in that sense, but there are new domains emerging which completely make it necessary to reevaluate that allocation of powers. Yeah. I definitely think so. I mean,
it's high time, and it is more than necessary. Actually, I was part of a recent workshop where someone spoke to the person who was the brains behind the 73rd and 74th amendment, which for urban local bodies. And, you know, after all the discussion, that person basically said, you know, the person who drafted it admitted he's made a huge mistake. And the huge mistake from a constitutional perspective is this. Whereas the powers of the union government and the state government come directly from the constitution, the powers, and as you mentioned, of the urban local bodies come from the state government. And this constitutional defect, right? What you call a birth defect, I call a constitutional defect, has been the source of our problem with urban local bodies. That it does not give them proper powers. Forget about the structure. There are problems with the structure. But it doesn't give them enough powers to be able to meet this Vixellian connect that... Surely, property tax at least should be entirely within the purview of this thing. Because I know as a local body how many properties are there. I can send my surveyors out onto the field. In about 2 days, I can map out every single property that I need to have and figure out what will be the land values and so on. Why should the state government care?
Yeah. I mean, this hit me the hardest, unfortunately, when I was in Whitefield, where there's a pub / restaurant called Republic of Whitefield.
Yes.
And I'm like, there should be more of this and not just as pubs. But I think to your point, Vixellian connection breakdown.
Totally.
Like,
and, you know, property tax is again famous bugbear. So one thing on property tax, there was this study done by the Economic Survey, I think when Arvind Subramaniam was the CEA. And they found out that the property tax potential of, they did a survey in two cities, Bangalore and Jaipur. We are utilizing just 11% of the property tax potential.
Yeah.
11 and some 14 for Jaipur or something like that.
Yeah.
That's for a city like Bengaluru, which is like, I mean... property taxes should be a huge amount that we should be collecting.
Between that and parking tax, we're done.
We're sorted. Bangalore could fund its own metro. Right? No, I mean, just kidding. But this is actually, again, shameless plug. We did a bit of research on this and we found that it's the one of the problems is that they have no idea how much they're supposed to collect. And because that this also is a capacity problem at the urban local body level, they don't even know how much they're losing, right? So they can vaguely say, okay, this year we'll try and collect maybe 2,500 crores. And you're probably, that seems probably even a 50% underestimate of what your actual potential for property tax should be. So it builds upon itself in multiple levels. And unless you feel that, you know, okay, every time a Bangalorean calls about a pothole, I should be able to answer. But I'll be able to do that if I know that I have, say, 6,000 crores a year in my kitty, right? As the BBMP, if not more.
Yeah, I mean, we are also doing some research on urban local bodies. And one of the conversations, we were like, how does this property tax goal number get set? And the response is, well, you know, ULBs say something and then somebody adds it up. Hopefully on an Excel sheet or some kind of calculator, not on. And
then once you are anchored to a number, you will say next year 10%, 10%. Yeah. But that base itself might be like hugely underestimated.
Off. Yes. And so then the effort becomes optimized towards increasing it over past year's collection rather than even reestablishing whether the base is the right number.
Yeah. So I think that sort of covers more or less the ground that we wanted to cover.
I feel this is a whole other
discussion. And believe me, if we had a chance, we would have kept Pranay in our podcast for another hour. We have come to the end of our discussion. I hope you all found it useful because this is a fascinating topic. We are going to keep hearing more of this. And I hope we've helped you make sense of how money goes through the system of our various 2.5 lakh governments, as we discussed. And I hope we were all able to take a nuanced view of how money travels on the system. So thank you once again, Pranay. That was a fascinating discussion. I'm sure we all learned a lot from that.
I certainly have.
Yes, we certainly did. And thank you for joining us on this podcast. Thank you all for tuning in. We'll be back with more episodes coming next Wednesday. Do stay tuned and thank you.